You're listening to Feminist Killjoys, PhD, in our Feminism, Pop Culture, and Politics, as discussed by two professional Killjoys.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Melody.
And today we'll be discussing NOLA to Angola with Rena and Jesse, two organizers who help raise money for incarcerated people and their families. We're so excited to share the interview. But first, Melody, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good.
Good.
I'm doing good.
Tell the good people how your week was.
Well, this is the first day I've been off caffeine. I quit coffee because of my headaches. Did I tell you that?
No. Holy cow.
Yeah. You so I had to. I know. Just.
Wow.
It's okay. I went to see a neurologist because I had a bad migraine this summer, and then it led to an MRI, and then the MRI showed some T2 flares. Don't ask me what that means, but all it means is that I just get a lot of headaches. I have a follow-up. So there's lots of people in my life that want to know more. And I have no idea because she said pretty early on in the appointment that I'd have to give up caffeine. And that's all I could focus on then for the rest of the appointment as to how I was going to get off coffee. But I slowly wean myself off, and I still drink decaf in the morning. So this morning I drink decaf, but it's basically the concept is that I get rid of something that is very well known to produce headaches, like caffeine headaches, to kind of see what else is going on with my headaches. So,
but it's possible you could do it again if they find it something else.
Yeah. I mean, but also I've been told by my therapist multiple times that maybe I shouldn't drink so much coffee because of my anxiety.
Right.
And really, it's psychological. I just having a cup of coffee with me. But once I make it, if it's decaf or regular, I can't tell the taste difference anyways.
That's good.
And I'm already naturally energetic. I don't really need the caffeine. It's just more, it's just part of my routine and my identity.
Yep.
But we're very lucky to live in a city that has a lot of local roasters, and a lot of them roast decaf versions too. So it's not like I have to go to Folgers decaf, you know?
Right. Totally.
There's nothing wrong with Folgers decaf. I just,
you're a little bit of a coffee snob. Let's just be real.
Yes. So I'm, so that's, I guess that's my biggest check-in. Everything else is going fine. So it's just, still getting headaches though. So I don't know what's going on, but.
Well, it's only one day off. So.
Yeah, but I didn't go from a ton of caffeine to zero. I weaned myself off, so I really shouldn't be getting caffeine headaches anymore because I was putting a tablespoon of caffeine in a quarter cup of coffee. So I mean, a lot of it is my light sensitivity, the computer screen and overhead lights and.
Yeah. Well, hey, this is actually so many wonderful things about having a whole bunch of listeners. So listeners, maybe you also get headaches and have some tips for Melody. Let us know.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Good shout out.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm trying to think if there's been anything of major note, and I don't really think there has been anything of major note. Just teaching.
Yeah, how's school
college?
Going?
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. I really, really, really like community college students, and I'm making an umbrella and generalizing, of course, but I just am having a really good experience with classroom engagement and interesting insights, and I'm just, sometimes that's a struggle in class to get that stuff, and I'm finding that it's not a struggle. A lot of people want to participate, and that's been really fun in class, and but I'm still, I think the theme of the past year and a half is not going to go away, that I think, just going to remind people that adjuncting is exploitative, and I'm not done being bitter about it. So apologies to all of you excited grad students out there for who I may be crushing dreams. But I know you all know the situation, and I hope everybody gets their dream tenure track job. It's just that we don't all get to have that. So that's just what it is. But yeah, so I'm still in the midst of processing all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I'm okay. I don't think I have it's finally cold and I'm so fucking happy. I've just been in a really, really good mood since the weather finally got fall-like.
So. I had to put a big long sweater cardigan I got on sale this summer and I had to wait, and now it's cold enough to put it on.
Yes. Amazing.
I love fall clothes.
Yeah, it's the best. Awesome. So let's keep going because we want to talk about who's ruining our dinner party, and we also want to get to our amazing interview, which I'm so stoked about. So who's ruining the dinner party for you this week, Melody?
Nike.
Mm-hmm. Say more.
Okay. Nike's been ruining my dinner party since, like, I was in college. But specifically, we are referencing the Colin Kaepernick ad that came out a couple of weeks ago now. If you haven't watched it, I would pause, and if you're not driving or riding a bike or something, watch the ad. It's 2 minutes. It's actually a awesome ad. It's one of those ads where they're tying a product to more of a feeling. So it's a typical Nike, you can do it. Here's all these athletes that beat all of the odds and, you know, came up and succeeded at the highest level. But the reason why it's making the news so much in social media rounds is because it stars Colin Kaepernick. And so he's the voiceover, and then he shows up a minute into the ad. So it's very strategic that they don't show his face right away. So you get really into the, like, thoughtfulness of the ad, and then boom, there's his face. And then he's a polarizing figure. And of course, there you go. Because now he's, you know, a major icon with Nike. I mean, the ad, this is tricky for Rachel and I to talk about because we're very pro Colin Kaepernick in terms of fighting against the NFL, standing up for police brutality in the face of a lot of hatred. But now his politics are couched in Nike, and Nike is a fairly problematic corporation. But Rachel, as the resident Marxist, can you explain a little bit about how his message getting wrapped up into Nike is a problem, especially along the lines of capitalism?
Because Nike is a corporation in a capitalist society, it is committed to gaining profits sort of by any means necessary. And that has included in Nike's history and present, basically either full on sweatshops or sweatshop like conditions for its workers that it, you know, it gets overseas workers so that it doesn't have to pay workers as much and doesn't have to follow environmental regulations as much and so on, like any corporation in the U.S. And so for Kaepernick, who's not only been outspoken about racism, but also about capitalism. I mean, there's a press conference where he's defending Fidel Castro in a way that I just truly act like legitimately fell in love with him when he did that. It's a little bit hypocritical, perhaps. However, we could literally say the same thing about each and every one of us. I mean, anybody who works for even public higher ed institutions, you know, there's still profit motives. We're obviously all of us have some piece of clothing in our closet that's not totally fair trade, living wage produced conditions. So, you know, it's complicated. And I think in some ways it's kind of like take that big money corporation, and he gives so much of his money away that it's like, you know, better to take it from people who would not do good things with it, and then he can do good things with it, even though that's not the end goal. That's what we would call philanthrocapitalism, where we rely on like good rich people giving money to the right thing versus not having rich people at all in the first place. So it's really complicated, and I'm not gonna sit there and like shit on Kaepernick, because I think he's doing a lot of really good stuff in the world, and I think that we're all complicit in capitalism. And so to try to have some sort of purity politics where he's not allowed to, you know, do anything for any corporation is like a tiny bit, I guess, unfair, but also it is not this anything liberatory to have Colin Kaepernick do an ad for Nike. That's not rooted in liberation.
I think it's just totally bullshit on Nike's behalf, because they are capitalizing on this moment to sell things, and they knew, like, they do. So for those of you who aren't familiar with like media and marketing, they did focus groups. Like they knew it was a risk, but they also knew it was going to work within a certain demographic. Some of my students work at Nike as salespeople, and I just want to let you know that they make $9.25 an hour, and they get 40% off products. And so like that's their in, because they want 40% off, but they get paid $9.25 selling sneakers that start at $100. Like, it's totally bullshit.
Yeah.
But what they also have told me is that when they're working there, people from Nike, I don't know if it's their managers or whoever, they like actually talk to them about branding. And so it makes them feel like they're part of the company. But they've also been checking in with people that are kind of tastemakers and younger about how they feel about, not about Colin Kaepernick, but about how to get the brand back on track. Because I guess Nike has been kind of falling out with the tastemakers, with the youth, even though it's so ubiquitous. So they wanted to get in that demographic again. And so this commercial with Colin Kaepernick, they have something with Serena Williams as well. They also did a giant marketing campaign with Maya Moore. And so they're getting people that normally would turn away from Nike because they have shitty politics, because of their slave labor, because of all the things that we mentioned. It gets us then to reconsider Nike. So now wearing Nike is actually like a politicized move, which is fascinating because for so long, like, I don't wear Nike because of the sweatshop labor stuff and just because whatever, it's Nike, they don't need my money. And now if I would wear it, it would like almost mean the opposite thing, you know? So, and it's all just for them to make money. And they did.
Yep.
They made a ton of money. And that's where the focus is like, did they make money or not? You know, instead of like, what does this message mean? I think too, just to wrap up, like the concept of political activism getting commodified has been a long time problem. And it's something that we all roll our eyes at because it's like, come on, dude, that was our movement. And then you you capitalized on it. This is not our movement specifically within the sports world, but like it's along the same vein.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent analysis, Dr. Hoffman. Yeah, I think all the points are super important. And, you know, we talk about this on the show a lot, like within sort of hegemony, you can only resist so much. And when you have a corporation being the face of resistance, like, you know, it's not actual resistance because it's still upholding the structural power system that actually is rooted in making sure that some people are going to remain oppressed, whether it's Colin Kaepernick or Kendall Jenner handing a cop a Pepsi in a fake protest.
Good connection.
Yeah, neither of those are going to be, you know, they're not going to do a lot of good other than the fact that I guess in the short term, Colin Kaepernick might do better things with his money than Kendall Jenner did for that commercial, for example. But yeah, so that's that. I'm not going to put like Colin Kaepernick totally on my shit list, but
man, it's Nike. Can I tell you one thing, though, that made me a little about him?
What's that?
After the pretty quickly after the Nike ad debuted, he posted on his Instagram account a link to a jersey that you could buy, and it sold out, and it said, like, know your rights, and then on the back it says Kaepernick and number 7, and it's dark blue. I feel like he debuted that jersey, like, right after the Nike ad. You know, it's like, and I don't know, at first it said 10 or 20% of the proceeds go to Know Your Rights campaign. So he's taking like a pretty good chunk of it. And it just, the timing was just like, dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I know you got to make your money. You already, you know, I know you got to make your money, but it just seemed like a little off.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
I'm still down. Colin Kaepernick is not, he's not ruining my dinner party. He can come to my dinner party.
Oh, yes.
And I will feed him.
Anytime, Colin. Anytime you'd like.
I mean, you just like, don't call me back and it's fine. But, you know, he can come. But fuck Nike forever, though, for serious.
Yeah. Fuck Nike and fuck capitalism. And fuck that, like, we have to find ways to resist in a system that won't ever actually let us fully resist unless we're literally, like, in the throes of a revolution. And that's really dismal. I think there's ways that there's meaningful resistance. This is probably not a super prominent example of meaningful resistance, though. Anyway, speaking of actual meaningful resistance, how about NOLA to Angola?
What a cool project. So I found out about NOLA to Angola through a bike equity listserv that I'm on. My colleague and friend Adonia sent out an email to the group saying, hey, my friend is doing this ride in New Orleans. It's called NOLA to Angola, and she's raising money, and it's all about fundraising for families that have incarcerated people in Angola, some transportation funds to get them there. So it funds the Cornerstone Bus Project, and then they can get money. The money's raised so then families can go visit on a charter bus their families that are incarcerated. And I was like, are you kidding me? It's an amazing, amazing project, and also combines Rachel and our, like, my interests and Rachel's interests perfectly. It's like bikes and prison work. So we were so excited that they were willing to talk with us, and we have this amazing interview for you. But before we get into that, we just wanted to share their bios with you so you know more about the people we're talking to. I'll go first. So we interviewed an organizer and a writer. So the writer that we interviewed, her name is Rena, and she's a children's librarian in New Orleans. She has gained internet notoriety for her, quote, white friends pay me for my therapy, unquote, fundraiser, which Rachel and I are both familiar with, and it is amazing. Now she is fundraising for NOLA to Angola.
And Jessie Channon, has been a NOLA to Angola organizer for 7 years. She first joined the project after watching several of her high school students go through the juvenile justice system and witnessing firsthand the impact mass incarceration has on families and communities. Jessie also does anti-incarceration work with the local nonprofit Ubuntu Village, where she co-facilitates their mentoring and participatory action research projects. Jessie is currently working on a PhD in sociology at Tulane University. That's who we're speaking with, and they will tell us more about what NOLA to Angola is all about. And we're just so excited for you to hear this, because we were just very thrilled to know that these two people exist and that they're doing the work that they do. Melody, will you take us there? Mel, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Welcome, Rena and Jessie, to Feminist Killjoys PhD. We wanted to talk to you about the NOLA to Angola project. So could you just both share, one of you can just kind of explain what NOLA to Angola is, and then also we'd love to hear how you got involved in the project.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us again. NOLA to Angola is a 3-day solidarity bike ride where riders start at Orleans Parish Prison in New Orleans and ride to Angola, Louisiana State Penitentiary. And the goal is to both raise awareness about the long distances that family members have to travel to visit their incarcerated loved ones, and also to fund the Cornerstone Builders Bus Project, which sends at least one bus a month, but many more around the holidays, for families to actually visit their loved ones in various prisons throughout Louisiana, they send those buses from New Orleans and from Shreveport. So this is our 8th year. Last year, we raised over $50,000, which funds more than a year of the bus project. We're now trying to expand to Lake Charles, which is another city in Louisiana by the Texas border. And I've been an organizer I did the ride in its second year, and so I've been an organizer really for 6 years now.
I am very brand new to New Orleans, actually. Yesterday was my 4-month anniversary living in New Orleans, and I got involved in NOLA to Angola because I wanted to find a way to give back to this community that has welcomed me so graciously. Also, I just love riding my bike.
Amazing. Thank you for giving us some of those details. So speaking of loving to ride your bicycle, why a bicycle? Why does this feel like a meaningful way to raise awareness and money via a bike ride?
When it first started, and I wasn't there when it first started, but it was started by a group of people who were really into riding their bikes and were kind of trying to combine these interests. So I think that it's more about kind of mobilizing people who have an interest in bicycling. I think also we bike through a lot of Louisiana that has a lot of history in terms of racism and in terms of environmental racism. And going through it on a bicycle really allows you to see all that. So we bike along Mississippi River levee, past all of these oil refineries and factories, and we talk a lot about environmental racism. We bike past sites where Black people were wrongly convicted by all white juries who remain in Angola. And we bike past, I think it's Diamond, where there was a huge chemical plant explosion. And a lot of these places along the route are places that, after slavery was abolished, were towns occupied by free people of color that have been totally decimated by industry, called Cancer Alley, and has the highest rate of cancer in the nation. So we try to focus on some of those inequities that we think intersect with incarceration, and going through it by bicycle is a really useful way to be able to really see that and feel the impacts of it.
I wanted to add quickly that I am someone who has had a family member incarcerated throughout their life, multiple times throughout their life. And for me, I actually never visited that incarcerated family member because it was scary for me. And this ride is me facing what I fear and experiencing the distance that it takes many families to visit their incarcerated loved ones and to experience how hard it is to actually get there to visit incarcerated loved ones, whether it's hard by bike, it's hard by car, it's hard by bus. And when it comes to our fundraising and raising awareness, all the riders are asked to fundraise, so to ask their friends and family members for sponsorships for the ride. And when we're asking our friends and family for donations, we're starting conversations with our own loved ones about the prison system and how it affects our communities here in New Orleans.
Yeah, and as Mina said, part of the goal is to highlight just how far away and remote these prisons are from where people live. So it really is a long distance to travel. And I think going by bicycle really highlights just how far and out of the way these prisons are.
So how long does the ride take? Like how many miles do you all ride?
It's about 170 miles over 3 days.
Wow.
So we camp 2 nights. And then the third day we arrive at Angola. And every October and April, every weekend, they have a quite famous rodeo and craft fair. So riders are actually able to go onto the prison grounds, which is, I think, a transformational and educational experience for many people. We don't go to the rodeo. People have a lot of mixed feelings about that. But we do go into the craft fair, which is an interesting event because it's both like a carnival type atmosphere. Like they're selling cotton candy and there's like bouncy castles, and also is a moment when many people can visit their incarcerated family members for a long period of time without a lot of supervision, if those people have permission to be out and walking around in the craft fair. So it's a really interesting mix of like a little bit of freedom for people on the outside and their family members, and also this strange carnival that's happening on prison grounds. And so we go in there for a few hours and then we drive everybody back to New Orleans.
And the bike ride is 170 miles over 3 days. If you drive to Angola, New Orleans, it's 2 or 3 hour drive.
Yeah, 2.5 or 3 hours, depending on the traffic.
That's a long ride.
Yeah.
I did a bike trip this summer, just for listeners who don't bike. That's no joke, that kind of ride. And we'll get into the riders in a little bit. I had some questions about who joins, but that'll come up in a second. But Rachel, did you have anything to add before I jump in with another question?
I was just going to say how much I appreciated everything you shared from just sort of, I'm just really into thinking about embodiment in a lot of different ways. And I think when our activists and organizing work can be really embodied and visceral, just how deeply powerful that is, and all the ways that you were just describing about feeling that distance in your body, I just think is really, really just so powerful. And also just, yeah, thinking about affording a car, affording the gas money that it takes to get there, affording the time to get off work, and just what, you know, immense obstacles there are that this ride is pointing out to people, and how important that is. And just a final just comment is, yeah, those juxtapositions that you were describing of like carnival atmosphere versus, you know, on a prison ground. I've spent some time doing work in mostly jails, but anytime there's like I went to the prison where I'm going to be starting to teach yoga in Minnesota, and there's just like this beautiful garden, like community garden, sunflowers everywhere. And then just like one step away, you know, you're in these cages, and just like anytime you see that sort of contrast is just, it's just pretty intense. So I just appreciate all of the things that you just shared. I know you want to keep going sort of on the what they were talking about in terms of transportation inequity.
I know you just mentioned this about how hard it is to get out to Angola, but can you talk just a little bit about the Cornerstone Bus Project, specifically the project that you help fund, and how that highlights some of the transportation inequity in general, but also in New Orleans? And so maybe Jesse has some historical information on that.
Yeah, we are so excited to partner with the Cornerstone Bus Project. They are an amazing organization. They're run by a formerly incarcerated person who was incarcerated for a really long time at Angola, Minister Leo Jackson, who was actually pardoned by Governor Blanco. And he has connections in Angola and so many connections in the community, and also runs a reentry program for people coming back from prison. And their goal is really, I mean, Leo talks so much about how the burden of visiting family members is an emotional one, and is very obviously just very difficult for family members. And so he wants to make the transportation and the means of getting there as easy and as comfortable as possible. So it's super important to him to rent charter buses and not school buses, and have them be air conditioned, and have them have bathrooms, and have the ride itself be as comfort and easy as possible, especially because many of these folks go every time he offers a bus. So we see the same family members who are predominantly
women and young children getting on the buses every month to visit their incarcerated loved ones. Well, yeah, they're an incredible organization. They also run a mentoring program for kids whose parents are incarcerated, and they have a jobs program, a job skill program, so they do a lot of important work.
And it's my understanding, Jesse, that the NOLA to Angola fundraiser is the only source for funding the buses. Is that true?
Currently, we're the only source for funding the buses, yeah. And we've also been the impetus, or our the amount of money that we've raised has been the impetus to expand it throughout the state. And Minister Jackson's goal is to really have it operating out of every city in the state, just because there is such a need.
Yeah, one thing we haven't addressed yet is how, until recently, Louisiana was the highest, had the highest rate of incarceration in the country.
Now we're number two.
Yeah, usurped by Oklahoma.
I think it's Oklahoma.
Yeah, so that we had that designation as a state until June 2018, I think.
Wow. Amazing that, that you're helping to fund that. And yeah, how important to shift gears a tiny bit. We're curious about learning more about the kind of people that end up doing the ride. Do you think that it sort of brings unlikely communities together, or what's the sort of feel of the demographic of who ends up showing up?
I think it's an interesting mix, because it's a lot of people who want to do it because they're into cycling. And so we have this population of people who are just really into cycling and that's their deal. And then we have people who are really social justice oriented, people who, we always have people from the public defender's office who come, or from various nonprofits that work on incarceration issues. And then we have people who have real personal connections who come, who either are from New Orleans and see the impact that incarceration has on their community, or who they themselves have family members who have been incarcerated here or elsewhere. So it's an interesting mix of people. And it's also an interesting mix of experienced cyclists who have done many long rides before and, you know, have the little shoes that clip into the pedals, and people who have not been on a bike since they were 10. And so, yeah, we really try to make it into a community ride and to facilitate people sharing their own experiences as much as they want to, and their own knowledge, both around biking and around incarceration and racism and all the different places that we're traveling through.
And there was a priority registration where if people of color and people who have experienced incarceration in their life or their family were prioritized as registered riders.
Which is partly because the ride historically has been pretty white. And we wanted to acknowledge the barriers that are there for people of color to participate in the ride, and specifically for people who have incarcerated family members to participate in the ride. Once we go out of New Orleans, the rest of Louisiana, I think, can be a unfriendly place for people of color, for queer people in various forms. And I think that that's really intimidating. And then I think it was started by a group of mostly white activists. And so I think that it's kind of created, that's often who signs up for it. So this year we're really trying to focus on making the ride feel more accessible and comfortable and as safe as possible for people of color and people who have experienced incarceration.
I didn't share this with either of you, but I wrote a book about bike activism and how white it can be, and then how it reiterates issues around racism in particular. It's really nice to see the intentionality, because that's what has to happen, especially if, what I've learned in my research is that if white bike activists start an event, it often tends to stay white unless you bring in that intentionality. And I know how hard it is after an event has been going on for so long and then you shift gears, no pun intended. So it really does take that kind of intentionality and like prioritizing registration and stuff. So that's awesome to hear. Does it sell out? I'm just curious logistic wise, like, do you have a limited amount of riders that you support?
We do. Every year we've expanded by a little bit, by 5 or 10, but this year we're aiming for around the same number. We had 55 riders last year, and this year our goal number is 60. And we always have many more people register than we can accommodate, which is partly because we're an all-volunteer-run organization. There's 8 or 10 organizers, and there's a lot of logistics around
safety and support cars and food and camping. And also we've gotten feedback over the years that some people really like when it's smaller and like having that more community feel and feel like they get to know everybody. But then obviously in terms of fundraising, we raise a lot more money when we have more people. So there's an interesting tension there. Yeah. And it's an ongoing debate, I think, among the organizers, if we want to expand or if we want to keep it around the same size. And I think one of the compromises that came out of that this year was keeping it around the same size, but also really prioritizing getting new riders and riders that we don't often reach to participate. Because often it's, we have people who have ridden 3, 4, 5 times. And this year, that's not the case. So it's a lot of people who have never done it before. We did a lot of outreach with nonprofit organizations here and different community groups to try to encourage their participation in various ways, whether it's on a bike or not. So I think that it, even though it's around the same size this year as it was last year, it will have quite a different feel than it has in the past.
Yeah, this will be my first NOLA to Angola ride, but also my first long-distance ride besides just regular commuting around town.
Awesome.
Thank you. We're going to switch a little bit and talk more directly about prison and prison activism work. So for listeners know this, we talk about prisons fairly often actually on this podcast, and we come more from a prison abolition standpoint, and we talk about prisons are just bad in general. And I've been reading about Angola specifically and how they are a particularly egregious prison. Could you share a little bit about what makes Angola stand out in terms of like a particularly bad prison?
Angola has a long history of oppression and human rights violations. Angola itself used to be a fully functioning plantation, and some would say continues to be a fully functioning plantation run on essentially slave labor. It's enormous. They call it the farm. It has its name because it was named after the plantation that preceded the prison. And it just has a horrific history of prisoner rights violations. Perhaps the most famous case is the Angola Three, who were three men who were seen framed for committing a murder while incarcerated. They were all active in the Black Panther Party within the prison and then were put in solitary confinement for 25 plus years. Yeah, and there's Jackie Summel, who's a local artist here, does a lot of work around that. She has a project called Solitary Gardens. It's about having people in solitary imagine what else that space could be. So that's a famous one. We also partnered, we always have speakers come on the ride from different groups. And last year we partnered with a group called the Promise of Justice Initiative, who was then involved in the lawsuit about the incredible temperatures that prisoners were forced to endure on death row, where it was heat indexes of 110 degrees. And many of these people are quite elderly or ill. And so it was, again, a prisoner's rights lawsuit, which is pretty rare, is my understanding, is that it's to file, at this point, lawsuits on behalf of prisoners' comfort and well-being. I mean, and also it's worth saying about Angola that because of incredibly harsh sentencing laws in Louisiana, 90% of the people in Angola are there for life. They're either on death row or they have life. So,
wow, 90% did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And so people are really there for extended periods of time. And so, of course, and especially as they get older, there's lots of health issues and, again, I think human rights issues around what's happening there.
Wow. Yeah. So sort of staying on the note of just, well, not Angola specific necessarily, but just prisons being terrible. There was, I feel like for the first time, sort of an awareness of how terrible it is to separate families during the most recent sort of extreme ICE raids that took place over the summer. And there were actually like lots of people rallying around this idea of not separating families. However, I feel like the sort of connection that ICE detention centers, which are a form of prison, and prisons that aren't directly related to immigration are both means of separating families. So could you just talk a little bit about, one, just if you have any thoughts on why that doesn't click with people outside of sort of mass immigration raids, which of course have been going on, you know, prior to the summer.
one, it, you know, maybe why there's not, people can't make that connection to prisons, if you have any thoughts on that. And two, just in general, what are the sort of impacts of family separation and when people can't visit family members for, you know, many, many reasons, who are incarcerated, you know, what's the impact of that on both the incarcerated family members and also the free world family members?
I'm glad you brought up the connection between prisons and ICE detention centers. In my own community, I'm Cambodian American. There are many people who came to the U.S. as refugees of the Khmer Rouge and may have committed a crime but served a prison sentence, and even after serving that prison sentence are now being deported. So that's one way families are being separated. And it's companies that are running for-profit private prisons that are running the many of the ICE detention centers also. So why there's that gap in linking them, I'm not sure. Yeah.
I think that part of, and I think that there's something that is particularly ideologically salient about anti-Black racism that is really particular to the experience of prison in the Deep South. And I think that we create all of these narratives around innocence and guilt. And in some ways, I think it's hard not to do that because it's very persuasive to talk about how innocent children are as like a political tool, as in like these children who cross the border, it wasn't, you know, they didn't even have any choice in it and they're being punished. But it inherently then is saying that the adults did have a choice and so they deserve to be punished.
Right.
I think sometimes when we set up talking about one group as innocent or even being like, oh, well, you know, the immigrants who are crossing the border, it shouldn't even be a crime. They're just fleeing violence in their own country. They shouldn't be incarcerated for that. And then unintentionally, I think it reinforces the idea that people who do commit a crime should be incarcerated.
Right.
And then we have a really incredibly broad definition of what constitutes a crime, particularly for Black people in the South, but I think all over the country.
A crime for Black people in the South is just often walking in public.
Right.
Yeah. And the idea of punishment, like when it comes to punishment of an incarcerated person, like we're not thinking how that person's family is punished also.
It's also, I mean, it's interesting. This is perhaps a tangent, but when we look at the Kavanaugh hearings and people saying, oh, well, he was only 17. And right now there's a huge fight in Louisiana because on all these cases of juvenile life without parole, which the Supreme Court said was unconstitutional. And so they're trying to look at these cases again. And the Louisiana Center for Children's Rights has been an incredible advocate trying to get these folks who have been incarcerated now for 10, 20, 30, 40 years for something they did when they were 17 or 16 or 15, mm-hmm. and has faced incredible opposition. And there's this idea that, you know, I just think the way that narratives of innocence are mobilized, innocence and guilt, really intersects with race and class and power in a way that sometimes isn't particularly examined.
That is such totally. A good point. That is such yeah. a good point. That was not a tangent at all. That is such a good point. No. And I can't wait to convey that to my students, too, who talk about that in the news, because they were saying the same thing. Dang. Snappy's on that one for sure.
Yeah, seriously.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I say one more thing? Because I just want to we did a small April ride that was more community focused. It was, I don't know, it was 10 miles or something. And we biked to different organizations working on incarceration issues here within New Orleans to try to connect riders to anti-incarceration work that's happening here, not only in St. Francisville. And one of the organizations we partnered with was the Congress of Day Laborers, which has been doing a ton of amazing anti-incarceration and anti-ICE work here at great personal risk. And there's a extremely large undocumented immigrant population here, particularly Latinos who came after Katrina to help rebuild. And they are very active in doing anti-incarceration, anti-ICE organizing. And we hope to support them more in the future. We raised a little money for them in that April ride. But I just want to name also that I think those issues are really, really connected. And they've done an amazing job
Congreso is part of an umbrella organization that works with a Black-led workers' rights organization, and they've done a really amazing job kind of seeing past the divisions that I think are created or are... I think often there's an attempt to try to pit Latinos against Black people, both because you hear because I think Latinos don't want to, especially immigrants, don't want to be kind of tainted by anti-Black racism that surrounds Black people. And I think they've just done an incredible job of collaborating and working together and demonstrating that these issues are the same issues, and we're all fighting against incarceration, even though it looks really different, maybe through ICE versus through the DOC.
Right. And I will have to look up where I read it, but I read that after Katrina and with the influx of Latino immigrants coming to New Orleans to rebuild, ICE conducted pilot programs in the New Orleans area, pilot programs as in how they raid and detain immigrants.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And I think it was in Metairie, which is adjacent to New Orleans, in that whole era of the ICE pilot, Metairie banned taco food trucks in the city.
Wow. Yeah. That's just enraging. The pilot programs. I mean, the taco truck thing too, but the fact that they did that, it's, and I'm glad that you both brought up, I mean, that certainly didn't make news that, you know, an influx of immigration was partly to help rebuild this part of the country that the U.S. government wasn't responding to. So I'm glad you brought that up. There's a lot of rage.
Yeah, well, before we hear from you about how people can get involved in the project and donate money, did either of you have anything else you wanted to share about any of the stuff that we talked about that we just didn't get to or you didn't have a chance to express?
I guess I wanted to express that prison is expensive. When you're in prison, you're paying for everything from your toiletries, basic items, phone calls, and it's expensive for families to visit their incarcerated loved ones. So that's why I am more than happy to fundraise for Cornerstone Bus Project.
Our final question is a very important one. Where can people find out more information about NOLA to Angola? And if listeners wanted to support you, Rena, on your ride, how do we find your fundraising page?
My fundraising page, personally, I have a tiny URL. So it's tiny.cc/RINNA. But there's also a team page.
We're using a fundraising platform called Mighty Cause. So if you go to mightycause.com/team/NOLA2Angola2018, you'll find a lot of the riders' fundraising pages. There's also a link to that on our website, which might be easier for folks, which is just www.NOLA2Angola.org.
Awesome. We will definitely link all of that in the show notes. And any other resources you'd recommend for people who are interested, maybe learning more about NOLA specific stuff? We just actually sent out recently a bunch of resources to our listeners on prisons in general, but any other New Orleans things people might be interested in or Angola specific stuff?
There's an amazing documentary called The Farm, which they filmed in Angola somehow before they realized, the prison authorities realized that they shouldn't do that. And it's, I think, very powerful and very indicative of what continues to go on there. And also, I believe, features Norris Henderson, who's a huge anti-prison activist here. He's the director of Voice of the Experienced, or VOTE, which is an organization run by formerly incarcerated people that does all sorts of anti-incarceration work. I will say that a huge campaign right now that I think has gotten not that much national attention is Louisiana is one, it might be two states, I don't know. But in Louisiana, you can be convicted by a non-unanimous jury. So you only need 10 jurors to convict. And that, is part of, a small part perhaps, but part of what has driven the incredible incarceration rate here, and means that people continue to be incarcerated, like people of color continue to be incarcerated and sentenced to prison by all white juries, even if when we look at the jury, we see people of color on it, because if you have 10 white jury members, they can alone vote to convict. And so we have, on our upcoming election, there's a ballot measure to abolish non-unanimous juries. It comes out of, straight out of Jim Crow. That's when it was implemented. And so there's a big attempt to repeal that. And there's a ton of organizations down here that are working on that initiative. And I think it's super important and it should be receiving more attention.
Thank you, Jesse. I would recommend a piece by the journalist Shane Bauer, B-A-U-E-R. He has a piece in Mother Jones about working as a private prison guard for 4 months in Louisiana. I can't remember where, but the prison was called Wynn Correctional Facility, and I think it was about 2 hours north of Baton Rouge. That piece, he talks about conditions inside and conditions that he wouldn't have been able to write about as a reporter. So that's why he went in as a prison guard, getting paid $9 an hour and in a town experiencing high poverty.
We love that piece. We've talked about it before. I'm glad you brought it up. And yeah, thanks to both of you for all of those recommendations. I definitely want to check out The Farm as well. I hadn't heard of that. Amazing. Thank you both so, so much. This was really insightful and inspiring. And I think I can speak for both Melody and I to say we're just really grateful for the work that you're doing. We'd love you to stay and join us for our segment on what we are reading, watching, and listening to this week. Do you want to keep hanging out for a few more minutes?
I'm ready for that. What about you, Jesse?
Sure.
Cool. Yay. Thank you. All right. Mel, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Can I sing them our jingle?
Sing the jingle. Do it.
Reading, watching, and listening with Rachel and Melody and their guests.
Yay.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay. I didn't hear the applause. I'm just going to assume that there was some in the background. But I'm reading this book that just came out called My Own Devices. It's by Dessa. She's a local hip-hop artist and poet and entrepreneur, and she's just really rad. So it's about her life being a touring musician with a bunch of dudes. So it's cool. It's a cool read. I just watched Girls Trip again, so which good. I think... Did it just come out on HBO? Was it... Did it get released on into theaters? Because I had to buy it through HBO.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it was out in theaters like a year ago.
Oh, good. Okay, so eventually, I don't know why HBO has their harness on that movie. Anyways.
That's NOLA related.
It is NOLA related. Yeah.
I love New Orleans, by the way. I know the show is not about how amazing New Orleans is, but I really appreciate that city. Obviously, it has its issues. I'm from Milwaukee. We have similar issues, but I love New Orleans. Thank
Come
you for
Come on down for the ride next year.
Even though I'm white? Is that okay?
There are, don't worry.
Okay. I was thinking about that. I was like, I'm going to totally come down there next year. And I was like, wait, they don't need any more white writers.
No, but you can stay at my place.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, so I love all things New Orleans as well. That movie is excellent. And then I'm listening to this artist called Yor Smith. She used to go by Caroline Smith. She's playing a show in Minneapolis tonight, and she just has some new songs out. So very local and women-driven RWL from me. Go figure.
Love it. Love it.
Thank you.
I'll go real quick. So I just picked up the book Joyful Militancy, which I'd been wanting for a while. It's an AK Press book. The subtitle is Building Thriving Resistance in Toxic Times. It's by Carla Bergman and Nick Montgomery. And I've only read the intro so far, but it's lovely and just like inspiring sort of like anarchist-y, new world building kind of stuff that I'm excited to read as my before bed reading. And shout out to Moon Palace Books. That's where I got it. And watching Insecure Season 3, finally started that, and I'm really enjoying it. And listening to, it's funny, Melody, I was also listening to Yor Smith. I just discovered that she changed her name, and it's good. Her new stuff is good. So look at that, our crossover. What about you two?
I'll go first. I'm a youth services librarian, so I read a lot of teen books right now.
That is so cool. You have the coolest job.
Come on down to my library, too.
I will. I'm already there. I already booked my plane ticket while you were talking, so.
Perfect. I'm reading a teen book called Here to Stay by Sarah Farazan. It's about a teen Muslim boy, and he gains, like, popularity in his school because he, like, wins the basketball game for the school. But in his popularity, that's when he faces Islamophobia at his school. But by the way, teen books are for everyone, not just teens.
Totally.
Yeah. I'm watching a BBC America show, Killing Eve, with Sandra Oh.
I hear it's really good. Are you loving it?
So, I'm loving Sandra Oh's hair in it also. It's beautiful. And I'm listening to the podcast Dr. Death, which is about a neurosurgeon in Texas who got away with harming way too many patients before he was stopped.
Eek.
Yeah. First episode is pretty gory because they recount like two surgeries.
Oh.
He botched. I know. It was gory for me. Medical gory.
Yeah.
It's a good podcast to learn how our medical system fails us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I read a lot of, I'm currently getting my PhD, so I read a lot of really boring books, actually. But I recently read Sing, Unburied, Sing, which is a novel by Jesmyn Ward, which I think is really the best book that I've read in years. So I want to recommend that to everyone. She's from the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
That's very relevant to our conversation.
Yeah, it is, because in the book, they family member is incarcerated at Parchman Prison in Mississippi, another infamous prison. Just such a special and powerful book.
Yeah, so it follows their drive to the prison, right?
Mm-hmm. And she's just an amazing writer, I think.
I love her too.
Yeah. And then also my friend, for the first time in my life, I have a friend who had a book published. This is called The Future Popes of Ireland, and my friend Sarah Martin. So I'm reading that now, and I love it because he's my friend, but also I think everyone would love it. And watching the latest movie I saw was called The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which I think was particularly targeted to appeal to me specifically. It's about a white gay girl. It's set in 1993, and it just really, and she gets sent to like pray the gay away camp. And I thought it was, for what those movies are, really, really well done, and devastating, and also not so devastating that you can't leave the theater. Listening. Oh, I've just been listening to Beyonce because Beyonce and Jay-Z came to New Orleans last week, and it was incredible. She's just incomparable.
Were you at that show?
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very exciting.
That's awesome.
We got the farthest away tickets you could possibly have. The Superdome. It was like such good vibes. Everyone dancing, and it was really nice.
That's rad. Cool. Amazing. Well, thank you again both so, so much. We are so excited to share this episode and hope to get you a lot of donations. And thanks again for all the work that you both do.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for amplifying NOLA to Angola's mission.
Absolutely.